Good day. This is Fred Frith. You are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. Have a nice time. Bonjour, c'est Fred Frith à l'appareil. C'est CKUT 90.3 FM. Et bonne journée.
Women's Foundation in partnership with CKUT is pleased to join you once a month to share episodes of our podcast, All Right Now What, where experts and our partners put an intersectional feminist lens on one topic or story we've all been hearing about. The issues and stories that just seem to keep resurfacing and make you wonder, what's this about? Why is this still happening? And how is it possible we haven't fixed this yet? We explore the systemic roots of these things and the strategies for change that will move us closer to the goal of gender justice.
Artificial intelligence is heavy on our minds and on our news feeds. Some of the conversations about it are exciting, and some are downright scary. Does AI hold promise to be used in a way that won't create more gender inequalities? I'm Andrea Gunraj from the Canadian Women's Foundation. Welcome to All Right, Now What, a podcast from the Canadian Women's Foundation. We put an intersectional feminist lens on stories that make you wonder, why is this still happening? We explore systemic roots and strategies for change that will move us closer to the goal of gender justice. The work of the Canadian Women's Foundation and our partners takes place on traditional First Nations, Métis, and Inuit territories. We are grateful for the opportunity to meet and work on this land. However, we recognize that land acknowledgements are not enough. We need to pursue truth, reconciliation, decolonization, and allyship in an ongoing effort to make right with all our relations. The development of artificial intelligence is happening at breakneck speed. It's a fundamental shift we're hearing a lot about, both good and bad. Its potential benefits rub up against its disruptive and destructive potential. Exploring its impact on our lives, its impact on gender equality and injustices, is more urgent than ever. What are AI's possible benefits for women and equity-seeking people? Can we implement artificial intelligence in a way that doesn't contribute to increased inequalities, harms, and injustices? How do we ensure that no one is left out of the decisions and implementation of this technology? Canadian Women's Foundation President and CEO Paulette Senior joined a fascinating panel on AI and reducing gender-based inequalities at the June Conference of Montreal, organized by the International Economic Forum of the Americas. Today, you'll hear clips of her and international experts speaking to benefits and pitfalls we have to act on if we want to achieve gender justice and avoid harms women and gender diverse people are at risk of around the world in this massive technological tidal shift. We start with Hazel T. Biana, Associate Professor at the Department of Philosophy at DLSU College of Liberal Arts. Then we move to Paula Ricarte, co-founder of Terra Commune, associate professor at Tecnologico de Monterrey, and faculty associate at Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Next is Paulette herself, followed by Benjamin Prodhomme, executive director of AI for Humanity at MILA Quebec Artificial Intelligence Institute. The panel itself was moderated by Nasser Farouki, Director of Education and Science at International Development Research Center.
First of all, I come from Southeast Asia, from the Philippines. So basically, we have one of the most dangerous transport systems in the world. So when visitors come over, I tell them, do not take public transit, take a cab, it's safer. So, you know, when we were doing some studies and we were trying to find out what do actual women and vulnerable groups need in terms of transit, we realized that in terms of thinking, in terms of the philosophy behind the technology that has been developed in the Philippines, is that most of these AIs tend to be victim blaming because they are not created by the women themselves or the vulnerable group themselves. So what we decided is that we went to the grassroots level, we talked to survivors of violence and transit, and we tried to see how AI could actually help deter these types of violence. So in terms of benefit, I think that AI can serve as a way to make vulnerable groups safer and make them more empowered. But at the same time, there's a risk. And one of the risks that you could encounter is the type of data that you gather that these women willingly give. So that's the reason why there's a challenge to ensure that your cybersecurity experts, your UBX designers, have that type of feminist framework of thinking in order to inspire the type of AI that they're developing.
When we speak about innovation, we are speaking about and a specific type of innovation that interests us is, and it's women's innovation, the innovation that is coming from communities, grassroots innovation, because currently we have innovation ecosystems that are excluding women, and as Hazel was mentioning, and communities from the capacity to innovate and take the tech and develop the tech that they need. I belong, as was mentioned, to the Feminist AI Research Network. I am leading the Latin American and Caribbean Hub. And in our project that is called Incubating Feminist AI, we are supporting multidisciplinary teams led by women that are developing technologies based in the community's needs and also that are addressing the problems that women face in our local context. Unfortunately, Latin America is one of the regions with the highest rates of femicides. And also, we are facing not only physical violence, but as you know, we also face algorithmic violence. And we also come from a region where we have many communities that have been systematically excluded from every institutional opportunity. They are excluded from innovation, they are excluded from education, they are excluded from the opportunities that can lead them to achieve a better life. So we are currently supporting many projects, and I would love to talk about only four. ADIA is a project developed by Fundación Vía Libre in Argentina. So it's an NLP tool that can be used to democratize the auditing of algorithmic biases in Spanish, because currently AI doesn't speak many languages. This tool helps to identify not only gender biases, but also class biases, professional biases. So it's a tool to understand intersectional biases in general. We have another project, it's called AIMRI, and this is a tool developed by the NGO Data Genero to help the judiciary system identify gender biases in the sentences that are handed down by the courts. So this tool helps women to have access to justice. We have another tool that is developed by BIT Policy Lab. It's called La Independiente, and it's an AI-based platform to make visible the work of women in the crowd work economy. So many women in Latin America work as data laborers, but they are not visible to anyone. And AI is a tool that is based in human labor. Another project is Técnicas Rudas, and it's working with an indigenous community in the north of Mexico to develop an artificial intelligence tool for water management based on ancestral knowledge and forms of community organization. So these are examples that show that technologies can be developed in a different way, considering the needs of the communities and developed by the communities and not by someone else. And of course, these tools are aimed to achieve gender equity and social justice.
I'm really happy to be a part of this panel. And if you had asked me 5, 6, 7 years ago, would I be looking at the intersection of gender justice and digital justice or AI, I would have said, not me. but it's important that organizations like mine are part of this conversation. because we are certainly on the forefront of addressing deep inequalities for a long time, and certainly one of them has been the gender pay gap, which has been persistent, which has remained part of the struggle around being able to achieve or move forward on gender equality, among other things. You know, we're also dealing with issues around gender-based violence. We see that the opportunity that AI offers is to be able to pinpoint, as an example, what are some of the areas that we could actually do further research in, but to do it at probably frightening speed compared to what we have in place now in terms of research, and be able to pinpoint exactly where the barriers are to being able to achieve or narrow the gap, and to do that in a way that is not in this sort of binary of men and women, but to do it across the intersection of identities that we know, for example, Indigenous women or racialized women experience much wider gaps when it comes to any injustice, but certainly in terms of the gender pay gap as well. It could be one of the things that we could actually utilize AI to help us actually achieve gender justice.
I would say at least two things. The first one is if we take a step back and look at AI as somewhat of a revolution or a very significant moment in time, I think that the first opportunity is just not to repeat mistakes, that would be the very least, but perhaps use this as a moment to do things differently. You know, one of the things we need not to repeat is to make inclusion a sideline of the conversation. To give you an example, and my intention is absolutely not to throw blame, but in fact to create a moment of reflection, the panel before us was a panel about economic growth related to technology. The house was full. The panel here, there's a bit less people, and it's one about inclusion. The panel before us was all male. And so I think that we need to kind of remind ourselves that inclusion lives in a way as a value you embody. And so it should really live throughout all conversations. And I think that's the first opportunity about AI. If we get it right, and we actually create the right tables with the right people, the right organizations, I think that's opportunity number one. Then I think opportunity number two is, yes, kind of concrete AI projects that support, you know, the voices of communities, and in this particular case, the voices of women, by putting them at the center of the projects. And so at Mila, I could give examples. We have a project called Biasly that aims at using AI to detect misogynistic biases in written texts. We have a project aimed at using AI to detect organized human trafficking activity. Another one around modern slavery. And of course, as you can imagine, both human trafficking and modern slavery are far and foremost affecting women. So there are very concrete ways in which AI can support that work. But my main message around those is really using that important conversation as an occasion to do better on that question.
The benefit of that is that you can prevent human trafficking potentially. The risk of that is you tend to implement certain gender stereotypes and profiling that is sort of a way to enforce systems of domination and power. So I think that's one of the risks. While you can prevent things, you can also reinforce things. Yeah, that's one example. Another example is I was talking about earlier with regards to the type of data that you collect from vulnerable groups. So, you know, this is the data that they willingly give. Fine, you let them sign all these data privacy concern, you know, tick boxes. But do they really read them? Do they really know what information they're giving? So, you know, that type of risk is something that we should be wary of. How do we control the data? How do we, who holds the data? Who keeps it? Who manipulates it?
I would say that currently AI is reinforcing, as was mentioned before, systemic inequalities. And I think that's the greatest risk, how AI is used to reinforce this historical, economic, social, cultural knowledge and also environmental inequalities. We need to prevent AI to continue being a technology of privilege. We don't need technologies that are controlled by only a few group of actors. We don't need technologies that surveil and control women's bodies. We don't need technologies that are used to monitor and profile marginalized people, for example, refugees or people that are in movement.
You know, as my co-panelists speak, what comes to mind for me is that those who hold the data, collect the data, hold the data, manipulate the data, hold the power. What we're really dealing with here is even further deepened inequities on top of the inequities that already existed prior. So it's really replicating that, if not widening the gap in terms of the inequities. So we see that whether it's in sort of surveillance data, we know in North America it's being used in different means. We hear in the States it's being used in terms of how judges make decisions around who gets and doesn't get bails. Pretty scary. We know what the results are. We know who are the folks that are in prison the most. It's racialized people, poor people, people with mental health issues. Collection of the data is already inequitable in and of itself because of who's doing the collection and then who gets to manipulate it. We know that women are not in the same numbers in terms of those who are at the table at the point of development or even deciding the parameters of the collection of the data. The same with racialized folks, people with disabilities, yet it's being considered as ways to address some of these inequities. So we're really using an inequitable process addressing something that's already inequitable. It's not going to end well. I think the risks can become insurmountable if we are not taking stock, taking pause. I mean, those who are much more educated than the rest of the population are asking for a pause, and that causes me not just pause, but it scares the living daylights out of me. So what is it that we really need to put in place around some safeguards, some guardrails around the development of the data, and then really questioning the use of the data, the ownership of the data, as well as how that data is being collected, and having folks at the table in order to mitigate, prevent, if not disrupt, that process.
All right, now what? This AI and Reducing Gender-Based Inequalities panel is a rich discussion you just got a small taste of. Watch the full thing by visiting the YouTube channel of the International Economic Forum of the Americas. Please listen, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. If you appreciate this content, please consider becoming a monthly donor to the Canadian Women's Foundation. People like you will make the goal of gender justice a reality. Visit CanadianWomen.org to give today, and thank you for your tireless
support. When you know how to respond to the signs of abuse, you can change the story. If someone in your life told you they were experiencing abuse, would you know how to help? There's a lot of stigma and silence around gender-based violence in our society. Too many people who experience abuse are shamed, silenced, and stigmatized, and too many people don't feel they have the confidence or knowledge to support them. If you'd like to learn more about how you can support a friend, family member, or a colleague who is experiencing abuse, visit signalforhelpresponder.ca.
You can be in a relationship that is unhealthy, unhelpful, that includes family violence, which makes you scared. And there can be a part of you that is like, well, I love these people. I love this person.
Family violence is a complicated, confusing experience. What's it like for racialized survivors? I'm Andrea Gunrat of the Canadian Women's Foundation. Welcome to All Right, Now What, a podcast from the Canadian Women's Foundation. We put an intersectional feminist lens on stories that make you wonder, why is this still happening? We explore systemic roots and strategies for change that will move us closer to the goal of gender justice. The work of the Canadian Women's Foundation and our partners takes place on traditional First Nations, Métis, and Inuit territories. We are grateful for the opportunity to meet and work on this land. However, we recognize that land acknowledgements are not enough. We need to pursue truth, reconciliation, decolonization, and allyship in an ongoing effort to make right with all our relations. Family violence refers to many kinds of abuse and neglect in families. It can happen against an intimate partner or against a child by a parent or a guardian. It can be elder abuse, sibling abuse, abuse by stepfamily, extended family, and more. It can be physical, sexual, emotional, mental, or a combination of all the above. I find umbrella terms like family violence challenging. They cover a range of experiences, and that's helpful. But they can obscure gender and power dynamics in their broadness. Women, girls, and Two-Spirit, trans, and non-binary people face family violence at disproportionate rates. Over the last few years, the rates have only increased in Canada. Umbrella terms can also make it hard to envision how different people experience things in unique ways, depending on who they are. For example, survivors with disabilities have shared how abuse perpetrated by family caregivers tends to get ignored because, in popular imagination, we don't always see how those who take care of us can also hurt us. 2S LGBTQIA+ survivors have shared how a family member's threats of outing them to other family members can be used as a form of control. These nuances of abuse are sometimes treated as mere add-ons. But one-size-fits-all approaches don't work well for anyone. What if the devil is in the details? What if exploring nuances can unlock transformative solutions that make millions of people safer? Simone Saunders joins us to talk about family violence in racialized families. Simone is a social worker and therapist in Calgary, Alberta. She's founder of the Cognitive Corner, a group psychological practice that focuses on trauma-informed, culturally responsive psychological care and psychoeducation. Simone specializes in the treatment of early childhood trauma, racial trauma, and attachment-based issues. She's also a mental health creator and advocate on Instagram and TikTok, where she aims to normalize mental health struggles and provide accessible psychoeducation. A note about content. This episode includes discussion of family and gender-based violence.
The premise of the Cognitive Corner is providing culturally responsive and trauma-informed mental health care. We opened the doors to the private practice in 2021. Before that, the Cognitive Corner was a social media page. It started out as an Instagram page in 2019. Initially, the premise of it was just to provide psychoeducation because it was something that I saw that was really lacking, especially with people of color. There wasn't really that much mental health representation from people of color. And so I thought that was really important. And it developed into a practice a few years later. I didn't anticipate entire practice coming from social media. And I knew I wanted to do something within social services, human services. But initially, I wanted to be a lawyer, which is, you know, completely different. And I found myself in social work. And so I think that's kind of been the theme of my life, is I will dip my toe into something. And then I often find myself in these places where it's something that I actually end up being extremely passionate about.
Family violence can happen in any family. How does it uniquely show up in the lives of Black, Indigenous, and racialized people you work with?
As literature shows, we know that people of color are generally more susceptible to family violence as well. And so that's definitely something that I see in my practice. Oftentimes, different forms of family violence can be sort of the norm in homes of color growing up. And so that's something that can definitely shape your mental health if that's something that you're privy to growing up when your brain is still developing or even in utero. It's difficult for your mental health because there's this sense of being hypervigilant all the time and having to be hypervigilant, whether it is, you know, parents screaming, yelling, arguing, whether it's physical violence, whether it's psychological abuse, financial abuse, all of these different things. When we're privy to that from a young age, then we carry that throughout adulthood until we process it in some capacity. Of course, family violence, especially with people of color, has systemic roots. And I see that a lot in my practice as well. And so I think that's something it's really important to address, because at some point we can stop the cycle if we notice it and we have the courage to address it. Black women especially are highly susceptible to family violence. My practice, I would say, is about 85% female identifying folks. Especially with Black women, there's the stereotype of strong Black woman. Stereotypes similar exist in different communities of color. Because of those stereotypes, there's an assumption that these types of women can handle more and internalize. That's internalized as well. I've talked to many clients who feel like, okay, it could be worse. I could be treated worse. And it's difficult because these stereotypes are put on these communities of color, Black women or women of color in general. There's this feeling of, okay, if it's not that bad, then I have to stick it out. Women of color are so used to bearing the brunt of a lot of different things. It can feel like, okay, this is doable, when it doesn't have to be. That's not a message that is communicated very often, is that it doesn't have to be terrible for you to walk away from something. It can be uncomfortable and you can decide like, hey, this isn't for me.
What barriers to safety do you see with survivors you work with? What might get in the way of their getting help and support?
I would say the biggest thing that comes up is guilt of, okay, sure, I can walk away, or sure, I don't deserve to be treated like X, Y, and Z. But then there's this guilt of, what about the other person? What if I just should stick it out? Do I deserve to leave? Because we might logically be able to know these things. And I think that's one of the largest things that I work on with folks, is that you can logically know something, logically know that I deserve to be treated better. I deserve respect. I deserve love. And emotionally not feel that. That discrepancy between your logical self and your emotional self causes the behavior of, okay, well, maybe I should just stay, because sure, logically, I know all of these things, but emotionally, I haven't been taught that I deserve these things. I haven't seen from other people who look like me that I deserve these things. Getting over that, I think, and processing that is huge. And processing the guilt of, you're allowed to leave, you're allowed to move on from things that don't work for you, that don't serve you, that people that don't appreciate you or don't love you in the way that you need to be loved. And it's definitely very, very, very difficult.
What strategies help break those barriers? What do you do in your practice when you're trying to help navigate traumas?
I find what resonates the most is kind of repeating back some of the things that they're saying in sessions. Because oftentimes we will talk, and especially in session, you're talking, you're processing, you're saying the things that are coming to your head. And a lot of times we don't really stop to think about like, okay, what I'm saying, this is a belief that I have in some capacity. And so I like to slow down and stop and say, okay, what I'm hearing you say is, I just want to repeat back to you, like verbatim, what you just said was, I don't feel like I can leave because it's not that bad. Let's sit with that for a moment. And in sitting with the things that they've said, which identify kind of their core beliefs about who they are, how they operate in the world, what they deserve, I find that to be more powerful than any sort of affirmation that I could give them. I think the biggest thing I have learned throughout the years is that at the base of virtually any client or any person, I should even say, is that we all just want relationships with other people. We all just want to be accepted. A lot of the roots of our core wounds is not being accepted or being made to feel like who we are isn't enough in some capacity, whether that's through, you know, seeing people who look like us or people in our family being treated a certain way, whether it's because we were treated a certain way. At the core of everything is that everybody wants to be loved and accepted. And when that doesn't happen and we have wounds because of that, it causes us to act out in a number of different ways. It's really difficult to kind of combat that because most people are struggling with the exact same thing, but because of shame, it isolates us and it makes us believe that I'm the only person that's struggling with this. it causes that separation that we're scared of.
I wonder how you've seen racist stereotypes factor into the experience of racialized survivors.
I think in particular to people of color, one of the biggest things that comes to mind is the fear of being a part of different stereotypes. So if you think about Black women, for example, part of the stereotype of Black women is the angry Black woman. Too angry, too loud, too X, Y, and Z, too much. A part of family violence could be the person that you're in relationship with trying to perpetuate that stereotype. So see, all Black women are like this. See, all Black women are X, Y, and Z. And in not wanting to fit that stereotype and not wanting to fit that mold, you shrink yourself. Even if you have very valid reason to be angry, very valid reason to be upset. So there's kind of like suppression on different emotions that can be very, very cultural. That's something that we don't see or talk about as often as we should, because these things can be very, very insidious, especially in relationships. I think we really need to think about, okay, am I able to express myself the way that I am? Of course, without harm to another person, but can I be my biggest, fullest self? And if I can't, why? And if that why is because this person is intimidating me, this person is causing me to feel fear, this person is gaslighting me, whatever it might be, then these are insidious signs that this relationship is probably not going in the healthiest direction.
What makes a difference for those of us who are going through the shame and blame of it all? What tools and resources can we access?
I think it's really about having open conversations and being vulnerable, because I think the largest thing is shame keeps us in a lot of different relationships, keeps us isolated. And the more that we're able to talk about what is happening, what is and isn't okay, how you should be feeling in general in different relationships, the easier it is to combat that shame, because two truths can exist. You can be in a relationship that is unhealthy, unhelpful, that includes family violence, which makes you scared. And there can be a part of you that is like, well, I love these people. I love this person. In acknowledging that those two truths can exist, and you can also choose yourself and you can choose to leave, it kind of takes away some of the shame, because I think that there's a sense of you have to be completely unhappy, you have to dislike these people, this person, and then you can leave. But you can still feel love and decide to leave. And if you're not being treated well, if you're uncomfortable, if you're just saying that, like, hey, this doesn't work for me, it's also okay to leave. But the more that we talk about it, the more that we can kind of unveil that shame. There's so many tools out there and they're amazing. But at the end of the day, I think what people really need is connection. So how can you build your own community? Whether that's talking to your neighbors, talking to your friends, reconnecting with people, talking to your coworkers, whoever it is. I think at the end of the day, the biggest tool that we can have is building community, because when we don't feel alone, we feel more powerful.
All right, now what? Check out the Cognitive Corner on Instagram, TikTok, and other social media. Please listen, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. If you appreciate this content, please consider becoming a monthly donor to the Canadian Women's Foundation. People like you will make the goal of gender justice a reality. Visit CanadianWomen.org to give today, and thank you for your tireless support.
And now the last episode from our mini-series on gender and health, ovarian cancer with Dr. Barbara van der Heijden. Since May 28th, International Day of Action for Women's Health, we've published 4 episodes focused on gender and health matters we may know bits and pieces of, but probably need to learn more about, including women's heart health, menstrual bleeding disorders, menopause, and ovarian cancer. As we wrap up this mini-series, we can't help but take a long view of equality, justice, and rights in medicine. We're thankful to the amazing medical scientists trying to turn the tide today. Our guest, Dr. Barbara van der Heijden, is one of those people. She's the inaugural Corinne Boyer Chair in Ovarian Cancer Research at the University of Ottawa, and a senior scientist in the Cancer Therapeutics Program at the Ottawa Hospital Research Institute. In this episode, she joins us to talk about ovarian cancer and the elevated stigma and serious gaps in knowledge and treatment around gynecological cancers.
It is a less common cancer, but it is a more deadly form of cancer compared to many others.
So let's talk about ovarian cancer. I'm Andrea Gunrach at the Canadian Women's Foundation. Welcome to All Right, Now What, a podcast from the Canadian Women's Foundation. We put an intersectional feminist lens on stories that make you wonder, why is this still happening? We explore systemic roots and strategies for change that will move us closer to the goal of gender justice. The work of the Canadian Women's Foundation and our partners takes place on traditional First Nations, Métis, and Inuit territories. We are grateful for the opportunity to meet and work on this land. However, we recognize that land acknowledgements are not enough. We need to pursue truth, reconciliation, decolonization, and allyship in an ongoing effort to make right with all our relations. Cancer is not an easy subject. I find gynecological cancers like cervical, ovarian, and uterine cancer especially difficult to talk about. A number of my loved ones have gone through it themselves. Like many things related to sexual and reproductive health, there's elevated stigma about gynecological cancers. Like many health issues for women, girls, and gender-diverse people, there are serious gaps in knowledge and treatment, too. The gaps are bigger for those of us who face discrimination based on factors like race, ability, and income. I find it especially ironic that modern biological research is based on cells taken from a woman named Henrietta Lacks in 1951 at Johns Hopkins Hospital. Lacks was a black woman diagnosed with cervical cancer. Her cells were taken without her consent and cultivated into the HeLa cell line, the most commonly used cell line in scientific research today. That's the thing about medical history. The most marginalized, dealing with the poorest treatment and outcomes, and most stigmatized and understudied health issues are the ones we've built our medical practices on. Since May 28, the International Day of Action for Women's Health, we focused on gender and health matters we may know bits and pieces of, but probably need to learn more about. As we wrap up this mini-series, I can't help but take a long view of equality, justice, and rights in medicine. And I am thankful to the amazing medical scientists trying to turn the tide today. My guest, Dr. Barbara Vanderheiden, is one of those people. She's the inaugural Corin Boyer Chair in Ovarian Cancer Research at the University of Ottawa, and she's a senior scientist in the Cancer Therapeutics Program at the Ottawa Hospital Research Institute. She loves talking about her research on ovarian cancer risk factors and how good models of ovarian cancer can shed light on susceptibility, tumor progression, and response to treatment. Dr. Vanderheiden teaches about science, academic integrity, and science communication.
My passions are the thrill of discovery. That's what made me and keeps me being a scientist. I love to inspire students to think critically about their work and to become good communicators of their work to the public. I love old movies and I love chocolate. If I were to sort of pinpoint why I became a scientist in this field at the time I did, I have to lay all the credit at the feet of Patrick Boyer. Patrick Boyer's wife had survived breast cancer and melanoma and then had died of ovarian cancer. This is in the mid-1990s. And frustrated by the lack of effective treatments for the disease, he went on a rampage of sorts, traveled across the country, tried to find where the ovarian cancer researchers were, found that there were very few at that time. And he did three things that I think are worthy of note. First, he started an organization that would support women with ovarian cancer. That is now Ovarian Cancer Canada. He funded a network of researchers across Canada who collected tissues for research, which was incredibly important to set the foundation for the opportunity to do research with patient material. And thirdly, and most importantly, he raised the funds to set up an endowed chair at the University of Ottawa that he named the Corin Boyer Chair in Ovarian Cancer Research, and I was recruited to that chair in the year 2000. So for 23 years, I have been building on his frustration and made it into my passion, is that we needed to change the world. We needed to develop a research community that had a focus on working collaboratively and cooperatively to advance better treatments, better detection strategies, better methods of prevention.
As a leader in ovarian cancer research, tell me some of the top things that we need to know about how this cancer appears in diverse women and gender diverse people.
It affects people with ovaries, whether they be non-binary or transgendered men or women. It is a less common cancer, but it is a more deadly form of cancer compared to many others. So 1 in 75 people with ovaries will be personally affected by ovarian cancer. And the survival rate now, about 45% of people who develop ovarian cancer will survive 5 years. So it's not the best. And so we do need to have a lot of work to do. All people with ovaries have some level of risk for ovarian cancer. And that risk is hugely dependent on a number of factors in their personal circumstances. But the most important or influential factors, I would say, include age. So it is a disease that occurs more frequently with increased age, a family history of that disease, and particularly inherited mutations like BRCA, BRCA1 or BRCA2, which put individuals at higher risk of primarily breast and ovarian cancer. Ethnicity then comes into play because the individuals who have those mutations are often more frequently found among Ashkenazi Jewish population, French Canadian descent, even now an Icelandic Dutch descent has specific mutations that increase the risk for ovarian cancer. So we're beginning to understand more the ethnicity associated. It's also associated with the lifetime number of ovulations. So in women who have no suppression of ovulation, and suppression happens by taking oral contraceptives or being pregnant. So if you don't have that, you have more lifetime number of ovulations, you have increased risk. Keep in mind that ovarian cancer is a global term that encompasses a large range of cancers, many of which start in the ovary, but some of which also start in the tips of the fallopian tubes, and even some now in endometriosis. Those are the risk factors, and you can see that anyone with ovaries have a variety of risks, and the level of risk they have is largely associated with a number of factors. Those are just the major ones. There are lesser ones as well.
What are our gaps in knowledge and research? Why are they there, and how can we close them?
Varied experiences within the healthcare system that might be those individuals would have different experiences within the healthcare system. And we know already there's lots of information about how that is true, not only for Indigenous people, for Black people, the LGBTQ community as well. So that is where the bigger issues might lie right now, and the ones that maybe are modifiable. I'm a scientist. I'm always looking at gaps. That's what we do. We find where we don't know information and we try to learn more. There's limited amount we can test in a lab environment. These kinds of human issues have to be studied in humans. I do some modeling in the lab, and it's very challenging to try to develop models where we can study these actions. And again, the diversity of both humans and risk factors and genetic identity really all influence it to a degree that makes it almost impossible to predict what the outcomes will be. Most ovarian cancers are diagnosed in later, what we call stages. It's progressed beyond the ovaries. The symptoms tend to be associated with abdominal discomfort, bloating. There's difficulty eating or feeling full more quickly than usual. There's abdominal discomfort in general. There's changes in urinary habits. Those are the four most prominent ones. And then there's a whole list of less common symptoms that can include anything from nausea, changes in bowel habits, fatigue, unexplained weight loss, menstrual irregularities, back pain. So the full list is actually on the ovariancanada.org website. So I encourage everyone to go through that. And as you can see, the symptoms themselves are quite subtle. And so the rule of thumb that we have is if you have a new symptom that persists for 3 weeks, then you need to have it investigated. You need to go to a physician and say, this is unusual for me. I've had this now for 3 weeks. It's not going away. Can we figure out what it might be? And I would actually encourage them to say, could it be ovarian cancer? because put that thought into the physician's head. All of these symptoms are gastrointestinal disorders as well, and they're much more common than ovarian cancer. So a physician that you present just your symptoms to might think, first of all, okay, there is something going wrong in their gut as opposed to their ovaries. I can't tell you the number of times that a woman has said to me, you know how I got diagnosed with ovarian cancer? It's because I couldn't get my pants done up. Bloating, it becomes often the trigger when women will finally, you know, go to a physician and say, okay, this is ridiculous now. I've put on some weight and I can't even get my clothes done up anymore. What's going on?
What prevention and advocacy needs to happen? And how can everyday people like me do something about it?
The non-surgical methods I've already mentioned, the use of oral contraceptives and pregnancy suppress ovulations, and that actually reduces the risk. Individuals who are doing something in their lives that is suppressing their ovulations might be actually reducing their risk of ovarian cancer at the same time, which is why I'm saying that those individuals who are transgendered, who are suppressing ovarian function, might actually be doing themselves a benefit that we have yet to determine whether that's real or not. There are surgical methods as well, and people like Angelina Jolie, who's made it famous for carrying a mutation that is going to put her or anyone at increased risk. It is possible to, for people who are at high risk, to go do the surgery that is called Salpingo oophorectomy. So scientific term saying taking out the ovaries and the tips of the fallopian tubes, because that will almost eliminate completely the risk of ovarian cancer. It's the same kind of surgery as if you're having your tubes tied or having a hysterectomy. If you remove the ovaries and the tips of the fallopian tubes at the same time, you'll eliminate almost completely the risk of ovarian cancer. Another strategy that actually had its home in BC and is now being largely recommended across the country, what's called opportunistic salpingectomy. For women or anyone with ovaries who is having surgery, abdominal or pelvic surgery, for any reason, then it might be worth raising the possibility of having the tips of the fallopian tubes removed at the same time, if the ovaries are not also being removed, because that reduces the risk of the development of ovarian cancer. In some circumstances where gender-affirming surgery is going to be used, then it's worth bringing up the topic of having the ovaries and the tips of the fallopian tubes removed at the same time. Advocacy? Where do I begin? There are lots of opportunities. Ovarian Cancer Canada organizes advocacy lobby days on the government on a regular basis. So contacting them and asking if there's anything you can do to help them in their mandate, I'm sure they would welcome the assistance. Also, you know, unfortunately, like everything else, being your own advocate, I think is incredibly important. Know your own risk. Be aware of a family history of inherited mutations that you might have, your own lifestyle. Do you have risk factors that might make you at higher risk, and therefore be more attuned to the symptoms? And you have to be constantly aware of those symptoms a little more acutely than women who are not at high risk. If you're going to be your own advocate, do so with your physician as well. There are all kinds of horror stories, but there are also a lot of very caring people who want to do the right thing. And they can only do the right thing if they know everything they need to know. A lot of the horror stories come is because the physicians weren't fully aware of what the circumstances were that they were walking into. Be free to share your use of alternative therapies, for example. Because if you are diagnosed with ovarian cancer, some of those alternative therapies actually counteract the activity of chemo. So you don't want to be taking some of those natural health products at the same time you're taking chemotherapy, because you're negating much of the effect of the chemotherapy. And other aspects of your life too. What are the factors that will make you less comfortable or more comfortable? They will listen and they will try to do their best to make sure that you are as comfortable as possible for what is routinely not a comfortable exam for anyone who has an ovary and a uterus. That will never be comfortable, but they can try to do their best to make it a little bit more comfortable for you.
All right, now what? Check out Ovarian Cancer Canada at ovariancancer.org for more information and resources. They have peer groups and tools for anyone going through ovarian cancer right now, too. Please listen, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. If you appreciate this content, please consider becoming a monthly donor to the Canadian Women's Foundation. People like you will make the goal of gender justice a reality. Visit CanadianWomen.org to give today, and thank you for your tireless support.
Listen to the latest episodes of our All Right, Now What? And our Signal for Help podcast produced with Media Girlfriends wherever you get your podcast content. Our French Appel à l'aide podcast.
Make sure my levels are at around 8.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Blah, blah, blah.
It's kind of a tongue twister.
Am I popping my peas?
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Start again.
Oh, should I do that? Okay.
I need a script.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
So you want me to go through it again and actually say that?
This sounds so repetitive.
See, now I can't do it. Once more, okay.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Wait, do you want me to say hello?
I'll have to do another one.
Yeah, maybe one last one.
Radio CKUT 90.3 FM.
Are you recording? You are? Oh. Can you press stop?
Êtes-vous locataire à Montréal? Avez-vous des questions sur vos droits? Votre comité logement peut vous aider. Pour trouver le comité logement pour votre quartier ou pour plus de ressources, visitez le www.rclalq.qc.ca.
The most violent element in society is ignorance. Born in 1869 in the Jewish quarter of Kovno, Lithuania, Emma Goldman emigrated to the United States at the age of 16 in the hopes of escaping a traditional domestic life in which her only use, in her father's opinion, would be to cook and produce many children for her man. Once in New York, where she worked in the garment industry, she was inspired to adopt a life of activism after witnessing the 1887 Haymarket Square riot, which led to the execution of falsely accused anarchists. She then began her career as an anarchist speaker and activist. Addressing crowds in either Yiddish, German, or English, she was a fiery and captivating orator who was not afraid of tackling such controversial issues as sexual freedom and contraception. She published her own anarchist journal, Mother Earth, from 1906 to 1917. Unimpressed by the women's suffrage movement, Goldman wrote, "Corruption in politics has nothing to do with the morals or the laxity of morals of various political personalities. Its cause is altogether a material one. Politics is the reflex of the business and industrial world. There is no hope that women, with her right to vote, will ever purify politics." She was sentenced to a year in prison in 1893 for one of her speeches and was deported back to Russia in 1919 for being an undesirable immigrant radical. Unable to live with the restrictions on political expression and the anti-Semitism of Bolshevik Russia, Goldman spent the rest of her life in exile in Europe and Canada. Emma Goldman died in Toronto in May of 1940.
Wilma Espin. It was on August the 23rd, 1960, that the formation of the Federation of Cuban Women, or the FMC, took place. The FMC organized masses of women by going from house to house in both cities and the countryside to sensitize and recruit women needed to set up militias and committees for the defense of the revolution, as well as to set up literacy programs, schools for peasant women, and networks of child care centers. Instrumental in setting up the Federation of Cuban Women, as well as serving as its president for more than 20 years, Wilma Espin played a very active part in the effort to overthrow the repressive Batista government. She was a prominent figure in the underground movement in Santiago de Cuba, where she organized clandestine work for the failed revolutionary attempt of July the 26th, 1953. After 1953, she joined and shared many responsibilities within the rebel army in the Sierra Maestra. After the Cuban Revolution, her main activities took place within the Federation of Cuban Women and as a member of the Central Committee for the Communist Party of Cuba. Espin and other women involved in revolutionary activities in pre-revolutionary Cuba knew that women needed education both to help them improve their daily lives and to participate in the efforts to overthrow imperialism. Espin and the FMC recognized that feminism and socialism needed each other to succeed.
Did you undergo a strip search at Riviere des Prairies or Bordeaux detention centers between October 11, 2016 and March 20, 2020? If so, you could receive up to $2,000 per eligible strip search. Hurry, you have until March 5, 2024 to fill out the claim form. Visit proactio.ca/searches or call us at 1-866-369-5118 to check your eligibility and fill out a claim form.
Nicest every time, better road of music, it's a ball. CKUT Radio McGill Montreal. Nicest every time, better road of music, it's a ball. Bojabantan says so. World of people call. All the Radio McGill in Montreal can read on CKUT. Reggae music for you and me, no color barrier.
Greetings, this is Mikey J.
Now this one is dedicated to
CKUT 90.3 FM right here in Montreal. Playing the hits, playing your favorites.
Afternoon, you're tuned to Butcher T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing your wide variety of music just to